Perhaps the most important global trend of the last few years has been the rise and transformation of information warfare. According to our next guest, in the digital age, real military engagement matters less than how it is broadcast. The result is a constant deluge of lies, shock humor, absurdity, and fear-mongering, a circus atmosphere created to disorient us and undermine our sense of truth. Disinformation expert Peter Pomerantsev has written the new book, This Is Not Propaganda, Adventures in the War Against Reality. He is a senior fellow at the Institute of Global Affairs at the London School of Economics. In the new book, he takes an analytical, poetic, lurid, and funny look at the contours of this new global order. Again, the name of the book is This Is Not Propaganda. And we welcome Peter Pomerantsev to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
You obviously have been working on this for a long time, but I'm curious as to how long you've been looking at this through the lens of propaganda and where we are right now.
It's a very personal story for me. Between 2001 and 2010, right after university, I went and worked in the media in Russia, making entertainment shows, but it also gave me kind of a close-up view of a new form of propaganda, which I described in my first book, which was called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. And that they're actually trying to capture the essence of what I was seeing in Russia, sort of propaganda that didn't try to prove the truth, but quite the opposite, said truth is unknowable and, you know, try to cast doubt on anything. And indeed had politicians and a whole media culture, which said actually facts don't matter at all. So that was a new thing, and kind of mixed different types of ideologies instead of having one ideology. And where kind of the border between spectacle and sense was almost impossible to tell, and where nostalgia dominated rather than any clear idea of the future. And I came back to the West sort of 2010 and wrote my first book and ended it on this kind of naive note going, well, you know, the West is terrible in so many ways, but at least we have politicians who believe in rational discourse and we have, a clear idea or a clearish idea of progress and facts matter in our political culture. And lo and behold, 2016 happens. And I see so many of the phenomena that I'd seen in Russia in the 90s and 2000s flourish in Britain and America. And the second book was kind of an attempt to understand why. And I've actually moved away from working in media. I now study media. I have a little think tank at the London School of Economics where we research propaganda and what to do about it. And so I went on this journey around the world, from the Philippines to the Middle East, to Latin America, to America and Europe, to try to understand what's happened. Why did the future arrive first in Russia? Whether there's something systemic about what we're seeing here, whether it's being repeated across the world, and what do we do about it?
That's an interesting point. Do you think, given this initially taking us outside of Russia and looking at the rest of the world, are we seeing throughout Europe, throughout the United States, are we seeing a mirror to what happened in Russia, or are we seeing something that is quite natural if it is allowed to run amok?
I think a lot of there's two crises going on really, and they inform each other and strengthen each other. There's one which is a technological one, which is that the means of production of information have changed, which mean that things that we once thought of as axiomatically good for democracy, so unlimited freedom of expression and pluralism, have now been kind of weaponized by authoritarian or anti-democratic forces. So, you know, instead of constricting, the information space through censorship, whether it's in Russia or the Philippines or Mexico, regimes will now flood the zone with so much misinformation and disinformation and confusion that people end up not being able to tell truth from fiction and kind of looking for a strong man to guide them through the murk. And in a way, you see the same thing in America. So that's one fact. That's technological. And I think that's kind of, you know, that's propagandists and rulers reacting to a technological change. But I think there's a deeper thing going on, which did happen in Russia first, which is more a cultural thing. So you've got to understand, in early 1990s Russia, you're in this unique situation where all clear versions of the future of kind of clear left or right ideologies, communism, democratic capitalism, that were meant to sort of like establish a version of progress have collapsed. So communism collapses in 89. By 93, democratic capitalist reforms are completely discredited. And instead of that, you have politicians and propagandists already in the early 1990s in Russia who realize you can't use the old models of left and right. You can't really talk about the future in any coherent way. So you have a new type of politics that focuses much more on feelings rather than rational ideologies and ideas. Focuses on things like, you know, raising Russia off its knees, which kind of, you know, anticipates making America great again. And which doesn't really try to use facts very much, because facts are very important if you're trying to establish an idea of the future. You know, a fact-driven discourse is very related to a rational future that you need to, you know, prove that you're establishing with evidence. Once there's no future that you're trying to establish, facts become much less, you know, much less important. And you have these kind of post-factual politicians in Russia in the early 1990s, like Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who are really pre-Trumpian figures, who are casting off the idea that you need facts, who are kind of these glorious buffoons, who don't even try to convince you of anything. They're just doing entertainment for entertainment's sake and kind of releasing this kind of energy, which kind of, you know, if you think about it, there's something rather inspiring in saying reality doesn't matter. It kind of fills you with this weird energy. And I think 30 years later, in the West and really across the world, where we've reached the same place where there is no clear idea of the future anymore. That kind of, you know, that kind of bland idea of globalized democratic capitalism collapsed in 2008. The idea that democracy was an inevitable part of, you know, history's arc collapses due to many reasons: the invasion of Iraq, the failure of the Arab Spring, but also economic decline, which gives us the sense that our kids will be poorer than we are. All those things contribute to a sense that there is no clear, rational future. And so you have the emergence of politicians, Boris Johnson or Donald Trump, who revel in the rejection of reality and who are full of nostalgia and who kind of enjoy giving a big kind of middle finger to the idea that, you know, factuality matters. And so I think we've arrived at the same place that Russia arrived to, you know, 30 odd years ago. So I think that these are kind of, you know, these are processes. It's not a case of Russia exported this. I think we've just arrived at a very similar place. But Russia is very good at negotiating this kind of futureless present, because it's been thinking of propaganda strategies to deal with it for much longer.
Peter Pomerantsev is a visiting senior fellow at the Institute of Global Affairs at the London School of Economics, and the new book is This Is Not Propaganda. The subtitle is Adventures in the War Against Reality. You mentioned Boris Johnson, you mentioned Donald Trump. So who's fighting on the other side? Who are the good guys when it comes to this war against reality? Who's on the side of reality?
That's a really good question. So what do we mean by good and bad in this context? I do think it's important to have those categories. So good and bad, I'm not talking about sort of any one political side. I'm talking about the people who still believe in a version of democracy which is founded on debate and deliberation, which is not a new idea. That goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks. The idea that we can have a rational discussion, exchange opinions, that facts are knowable and we can discuss them, and that we can make consensus decisions that, you know, agree to disagree, agree that we have different sides of the debate, but kind of respect each other enough. And that is kind of, you know, the idea of liberal democracy as a process of debate and deliberation, which kind of powered our Enlightenment ideals of the democratic process. You can be on the left, on the right, you can be in any kind of position, but you still believe in that process. You know, when you have leaders like Johnson and Trump who just don't care about the facts, then it's virtually impossible to engage in a debate with them, because, you know, if you can't have enough shared reality and enough trust in each other in order to have that debate, then it crumbles. So that's good and bad. And now, like, authoritarian leaders like Vladimir Putin are very, very comfortable with this. You know, they're very comfortable with a world of chaos where communication is breaking down, where, you know, we start to look for kind of strong men to lead us through this chaotic and dark, conspiracy-filled world. So that's what I mean by good and bad. The people who want to sustain a deliberative debate and the ones who are comfortable and at ease in a world where there is no truth and chaos reigns.
So when it comes to democracy and it comes to the fact that both men were elected, what does that say about us that the majority of the people, and I realize in all cases this can be questionable, people are going to say yes, but more votes here, more votes there, and I understand that. However, that through the rules that we have in place, both these men and many others that would fall into this category are in power. How does that happen?
It means that enough people are prepared to accept their approach, which I think is a new thing. That it means enough people have lost faith that they have a future that they want to strive for. Because I would like to repeat this idea that facts exist as part of a discussion about a future people think they can reach. We have this rational debate about what is the better version of the future, and here's the evidence that we're achieving it, and my evidence is stronger than your evidence. It's all about the future. And that, I think, means that enough people don't see a future for themselves, don't see a place for themselves. I mean, on a very simple level, know their kids are going to be earning less than they are. On a more kind of grand level, don't understand the story of where we're trying to head as societies. That's what's really crumbled and disappeared. So that means enough people were ready to invest into a rejection of a factual-based discourse. And we really have to understand the roots of that and why that's happened.
Do they see it as fact, though? Do they see it as Kellyanne Conway said, and also Daniel Patrick Moynihan, you can have your own set of facts. Well, what if you do?
No, I think the part of the joy of Trump, of his speeches, or of Johnson, of Putin, but even more like a lot of the propagandists around Putin who do a lot more media work than he does, of Bolsonaro, of Duterte, is the way they put up a big fat middle finger to factual discourse. We don't care. We're going to have this kind of fun, crazy, anarchic time. That's the kind of there's a huge pleasure in that. Look, facts at a very kind of deep level remind us of our own mortality. They're not very pleasant things. And this kind of release into a carnivalesque fantasy land is very pleasurable. We really underestimate the pleasure that these leaders give. I think it's very important that Trump came out of reality show. Reality show is not about reality at all. It's about the impossible. It's about, the fool being made king for a day, these kind of magical escapades. He comes from a folkloric land where there are no hard and fast rules. And that's part of his appeal. I think we kind of miss the pleasure that generates. And it's a huge challenge to tell people, no, actually, facts are really important, and to make them attractive and pleasurable and make them, something that people want to be involved in. So I wouldn't underestimate that.
It seems like, as you say, that the truth can be messy. And a lot of us don't want to deal with the mess. And yet this propaganda is making things even messier to eventually, we hope, eventually we'll have to clean up. So what do the people that are concerned about facts, that are concerned about truth, to do about not only cleaning up what is currently going on, but see to it that there is a verification of the truth and its importance in our society and culture?
Yeah, no, truth is messy, and verification is slow and boring. I wouldn't put the stress there. I would put the stress on trust and being able to have and communication and being able to talk to one another again and being able to have an environment where
all right, so how do we trust each other? How do we have that how do we have that dialogue?
That's the critical question. That used to be kind of partly the role of public service media to bring people together, to sort of ensure diversity and a common framework for debate. I think we need those public service ideals reiterated in a social media environment. That's a lot of the research that we do at my little initiative at the London School of Economics, where we look at different polarized groups online who live in their own, I don't like the term echo chambers, but let's use it as a shorthand, but we live in this very fragmented world. And we try to work out what are the things what are the values people have in common underneath the surface differences? And we try to sort of produce content. We work with media to produce content where different groups will engage in because they care about these themes, and then in a way that encourages them to have a constructive debate. I mean, the problem with social media at the moment is that it encourages polarization, extremism, and scandalization. Sort of the logic of likes and shares on social media does not encourage a constructive discourse and trust. It encourages you to take the most extreme position to get more likes and shares. So can we think of other metrics? Yeah, can we think of metrics when we produce a piece of media content that encourage constructive discourse and trust? We can measure these things, yeah? It means rejecting the logic of social media as it is now. And that probably means not making money out of it, because the ad tech system, you know, the ads are generated by more likes and clicks, which reward, let's put it in a word, Trump-like behavior. So you're going to have something, I think, a civic movement, which is imbued with public service media virtues, whose work it is every day to get up and build this common discourse. It's a job. It's producing content, but also encouraging conversations online. So someone has to do that. There's lots of little experiments happening, you know, in America and Europe about how you might do that, but it has to be repeated at scale. I think this has to be a huge civic movement, and it might be like, you know, a huge role for civil society for the next century. So I think that's very important. But look, we can do simpler things than that. We've got these debates at the moment in the U.S., the Democratic debates. Are you following them?
Yes.
So look at the way they're designed. They're designed in a kind of reality show logic. So if right. you mention someone's name, you know, and you insult them, they have 45 seconds to respond, to punch you back.
Right.
And if they mention your name, you get 45 seconds. So it encourages polarization and a kind of, you know, WWF version of interaction, which, you know, it's a reality show kind of principle, and surprise, surprise, the reality show candidate tends to do quite well on it. Let's do them in a completely different way. Let's give them challenges to show how they're going to collaborate together to solve policy issues. Yeah, I mean, that's not a hard thing to do. So we immediately encourage them to work together to show how they're going to collaborate, to think in a future-orientated way. And we immediately have a different kind of conversation. That's a small tweak that we could do to the way the debates are structured, which already would have a much more constructive and trust-building type of conversation.
But who is setting the rules on that? I mean, that is what it comes down to, right? I mean, the fact that, okay, but who's making that decision as to this is what we're going to discuss, this is what we're going to work together on, and this is what we're going to try to solve?
Well, in the context of the debates, it's, you know, it's the networks. But because the networks are addicted to an ad industry that rewards this kind of behavior,
right.
Kind of closed in the loop. And also, I think there's been a lot of cultural conditioning from a generation of reality shows. So look, if you go back to, which have normalized this sort of interaction, yeah, if you go back to the first reality shows that were made, sort of the first Big Brother, I mean, there was a real shock to the producers because people started collaborating. That's what people actually do. If you put them in a stressful situation, they collaborate. That's normal. And the producers were like, oh, no, well, this isn't going to work. And they started engineering conflicts and casting people who were, you know, combustible and scandalous, and encouraging the sort of behavior that that got the cheapest kinds of ratings, that that channel the most basest forms of human desire to do with outrage and anger, and that kind of became a norm. That became a cultural norm, and it's almost like the TV political debate started imitating that. There are other desires that we can tap into. There are ways of, you know, which aren't about sort of like outrage and cheap conflict, which appeal to our notion of the need to collaborate and the need to build something together. These are also very, very deep emotions. I'm not saying that, you know, these debates should be boring. They should still be an adventure, without a doubt, but they can appeal to completely other things. But it will take an effort, and maybe in the short term it will mean sort of rejecting the immediate logic of advertising.
And what role does democracy have in this, in the sense of eventually the American people are going to decide who the candidate is on the Democratic side and on the Republican side?
Look, democracy is, you know, dangerous, combustible, full of terrible decisions. That's why we love it. That's why it's fun. What I'm not, you know, it's completely not my job to kind of like decide what people decide, so to speak. What I'm concerned about is what is the forum and the rules of engagement for that decision to be made. At the moment, there's a distinct lack of engagement in America. I mean, America really reminds me of a country like Ukraine, which is at war, with the degree of polarization that happens here, the way we have to, you know, at least two bits of society living in separate bubbles, and someone's got to have to start building the bridges between them and fostering a conversation between them. Look, the kind of democracy that we say we aspire to depends on a level of trust and a level of interaction. It can't survive a conspiratorial worldview where you just don't trust the other side because you believe they're, you know, motivated by hidden powers. There has to be enough of a shared reality for this sort of democracy to survive. If not, it just won't. And we'll end up with some other kind of system. But I still believe in the values of deliberative democracy. As I say, they didn't start yesterday. They start with the ancient Greeks. And it's historically, it's proved to be a pretty successful version.
The name of the book is This Is Not Propaganda, Adventures in the War Against Reality. Peter Pomerantsev is the author. The book is published by Public Affairs. Peter, thank you very much for your time. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
No, it's my pleasure. It's all mine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is This Is Not Propaganda, Adventures in the War Against Reality. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.